In the beginning, there were two gods. Apsu, the god of fresh water, and Tiamat, the goddess of salt water. And these two gods got together, and from Apsu and Tiamat came two more gods, Lemu and Lehemu, and from Lemu and Lehemu came Ansar and Kinsar, and from Ansar and Kinsar came Anu, and from Anu came Ea, and from Ea came Marduk. Thus we have the gods of creation and the gods of the universe. Well, one day, Apsu, who is now a relatively grumpy old man, is sitting around and he's hearing the noise of all of his descendants. And he's really, really frustrated and really, really annoyed by all of this noise. And so he gets this clever idea of, well, maybe to eliminate the noise, the best thing for me to do is just to eliminate my descendants. And so he begins to plot out killing off his offspring. Now, one of his offspring, his great, great grandson, Ea, catches wind of this and he hears it. And so he decides the best thing for him to do to prevent the elimination of all of Apsu's descendants is for Ea to eliminate Apsu. And so Ea kills Apsu. Now, this makes Tiamat very, very sad, very, very angry, very, very frustrated. And as a result of Ea killing Apsu and Tiamat's frustration with all of this, Tiamat decides that she is going to evoke war against all of her descendants. Now, Tiamat's descendants look to the youngest descendant, Marduk, to be the one to represent them in battle against Tiamat. So we come to the showdown between great-great-great-grandson Marduk versus great-great-great-grandma Tiamat, and they're duking it out mano a mano. Now, at one point in the battle, Marduk sends forth a great wind, and it fills up and inflates Tiamat. And Tiamat, who is now inflated like a balloon, is paralyzed and can't do anything. And at this point, Marduk pulls out an arrow. And Marduk fires an arrow through his great-great-great-grandma and kills her. Having killed her, Marduk goes up to Tiamat, rips her in half, and puts half of her in the sky to hold the waters above, and puts half of her below to hold the waters below. Never should the two shall meet. And Marduk then reigns as the great god among all the gods. Now, from this point on, the gods would go on to create human beings. And these human beings had a very specific role in the created order. And the human beings were meant to be slaves to the gods. Meaning the role of the humans were to do whatever the gods told them to do and make sure that they appeased the gods and made sure that the gods were not angry with them. Now, there was one particular human being who was above all other human beings, and this was the human king. And the human king had a very special place in the created order because the human king was seen to have been created in the image of the gods. Being king meant that he had the divine image imprinted upon him. And the human king was meant to represent the gods in the created order, to rule over the rest of the human beings as a representative of the gods. And thus the creation of heaven and earth and all of the universe. Now, I'm assuming most of us are not familiar with this story. This story, of course, being the Babylonian creation story. I assume for most of us, we're much more familiar with what we might call the Genesis creation story, which goes in the beginning when God created the heavens and the earth. Now, if we're familiar with this story, which I assume many of us are, we could probably go on and list out in detail what happened on each day that's depicted representing how God went about creating everything, right? For most of us, the Babylonian creation story the creation story of the Babylonian people and the Genesis creation story tend not to be interspersed too much, right? We can talk about the Genesis creation story without ever really talking about the Babylonian creation story. However, this is a relatively unique phenomena in the history of these two stories. See, these two stories were actually contemporaries at one point in time. So you have the Israelites, the Jewish people, And they are sent out into exile, which means the Babylonian people come in, they ransack them, they take them over, and they displace them and scatter them into Babylonian territory. So while these the Jewish people are scattered and they're trying to formulate, while they're trying to solidify, while they're trying to write down their creation story, which we find in Genesis, they are interspersed among the Babylonian people. And as they are trying to solidify and write down and come to this Genesis creation story in its current state, the Babylonian creation story is all around them. You can picture, like, they're dispersed in these like little camps all throughout Babylon, and they're hearing the stories of the Babylonian creation story as they're telling their own creation story. And what we see are an awful lot of similarities between these stories, and while they may not necessarily be competing stories, they certainly are influencing one another. So as we look at the Genesis creation story, it's not so much what's present that's important to us, but it's actually what's unique to the story that's important to us. Because there's an awful lot of overlap between these stories, because they're written around the same time, and they're, as one scholar said, that they have a similar conceptual understanding of the world, right? They think the world works in the same way. So there's a lot of overlap between these stories, so it's not just what's present, but it's what's unique that's important to us. Now, what's unique about the Genesis creation story is the way that it begins with one God. We don't see that there's this like conglomeration of a bunch of different gods with different competing purposes and interests, but rather there's one God. And in the Genesis creation story, as this one God goes out to create, the way that this God goes about creating, well, it's nonviolent. There's no violence in the story, but rather this God speaks, and the creation listens to this God's voice and bursts forth into life. Whereas in the Babylonian creation story, there's all of this fighting, all of this drama, all of this tension, all of this killing in order to bring about creation. Now, the Genesis creation story is also unique in that it comes to what we might call like the penultimate creation among all of creation. And that would be the creation of human beings. Genesis 1:27 tells it this way. It says, "So God created humankind in his image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them." Now, this statement is unique in comparison to the Babylonian creation story, because here we see this pronouncement that all of humankind is created in the image of God. To be created in the image of God is not reserved for a select few. It's not reserved for the elite among elite among elite. But rather, to be created in the image of God is something that is bestowed upon all of humanity. Every single human being to ever take breath has been created in the image of God. It's also interesting to note that Genesis goes into detail to name male and female, both being created in the image of God, given that this is such a male-dominated world. But the story doesn't stop here, because Genesis continues to push its own agenda, push its own agenda into what it means to be a human being created in the image of God. And in the very next line, we read, "God blessed them, and God said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves upon the earth.'" See, we see here already that God is doing something different in Genesis than what the gods in the Babylonian story were doing. Because here, God has created all of humankind in God's image, and then God goes ahead and blesses them and invites them to have dominion over the created order, to have control over the created order, to have authority over the created order. See, human beings in the Genesis story aren't just simply slaves, but rather they're invited to join in what God is doing, to take part in the ongoing process of creation. So human beings are created in God's image. Human beings are invited to have dominion. But this begs the question of, like, Well, what does it mean to have dominion over creation? What does it mean to have control and power and authority over creation? I think that's a really important question for us to ask because, I don't know about you, but as I read the news and as I look out in the world around me, it's really easy for me to find really ugly examples of what having dominion can look like, right? We see all sorts of examples of having dominion that involves violence and oppression and coercion and all sorts of ugly expressions of it. And I don't think that that's what God is inviting us into. But rather, to answer the question of what does it mean to have dominion, I think we need to just back up one verse and look back at this grand declaration that all of humankind is created in a particular image. Because the previous verse tells us that humankind is created in God's image. And so as we begin to think about what does it mean to have dominion, it means that we take our cues from the God in whose image we were created. And as we think about God having dominion, God having control, power, and authority over the creation, what we see is pretty unique in comparison to the Babylonian gods. Because again, we see a God who is nonviolent, who isn't causing chaos in order to create, but rather just speaks, and creation listens to this God's voice. Likewise, we get this depiction that God is intimately involved and intimately connected in the creation. As we see in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, in these two creation stories that we have, we see God scooping up the dust and breathing life into it. There's this intimacy with the creation. And what we see with God as God has dominion over creation is that God is cultivating life and flourishing in the potential of life, rather than what we see with the Babylonian gods where they're trying to conquer it. All of this reaches an even more dramatic level in Genesis chapter 2, when in that depiction of the creation story where we see Adam and Eve, the first humans being created, and God inviting them to join God in caring for the garden. It seems as though God is inviting them to become co-creators with God. Not slaves, but co-creators with God, to join in on the ongoing process of creation. Now, all of this is getting somewhere, I promise. So what we have here in Genesis chapter 1, and even if we want to look into Genesis chapter 2, is what we would call a creation story or an origin story. Now, this is a very particular type of writing or a very particular genre in the ancient world, and it was never meant to be read as like a historical book or a scientific book. In fact, to try to read it in a historical or scientific account kind of misses the mark of what they were going at. But rather, what they were aiming to do was to spark some inspiration and to spark some imagination as it surrounds the question of what does it mean to be created as a human? And what does it mean for us currently to be a human? And what Genesis 1, and if we want to think about Genesis 2, seems to be pointing towards is this idea that God invites us to be co-creators with God. That we're not just subject to the role of a slave of God, but rather we're invited to be co-creators with God, to join in on the ongoing process of creation. Now, to be clear, to be a co-creator with God, to have dominion, control, power, authority over creation, doesn't mean that we can do just simply whatever we want to do with creation. But rather, we acknowledge that we're created in the image of God, which means that we take our cues in dominion of having power, control, authority, of being a co-creator with God. We take our cues from God. And what we see all throughout the creation story in Genesis is that we have a God that cultivates, not conquers. That this God is intimately involved and is cultivating life and flourishing in the potential of life, rather than conquering others to get God's way in some way, right? But rather a God that's cultivating life. And now as we think about what it means for us to be created in God's image, As we think about what it means to be invited to have dominion and power and control and authority over creation, I think the same applies to us. That as we think about what it means to have dominion, it means that for us, we cultivate, not conquer. Now, all of this points to a particularly like Mennonite-esque sort of word. And that's the word stewardship, which is a way of talking about caring for things, right? We are stewards of something if we care for it or manage it or use it in some way. Genesis 1 and 2 seems to be pointing to this idea that all of this is God's. We're just simply invited into it, to care for it, to manage it, to use it, to steward it in some way. Theologian Justo Gonzalez is quoted as saying, "Very little in Christian doctrine is as misunderstood as stewardship. Yet stewardship is absolutely essential to a life of faith. If we misunderstand the relationship between stewardship and faith, we miss the opportunity to join in the work, to join God in the work God values." See, Gonzalez seems to be speaking awfully highly of this idea of stewardship. And we see stewardship laid out so beautifully in the first pages of Scripture. Stewardship, or call it co-creation, or call it this invitation into dominion, whatever you want to call it. But it brings us to our next value as a congregation, and that is stewardship of resources. And we take all of this, these ideas, what we see happening in the Genesis creation story, this idea of co-creation, of having dominion, of being created in the image of God, and we see that this is an important thing. And so as we think about what it means for us to be a congregation, we say that we want to hold this as a value. We want this to be something that shapes our shared life together. Now, what this means for us as a congregation is that as we communally begin to think about how to use or manage or care for the resources that have been entrusted to us, it means that we filter those decisions through this sort of question. What will cultivate, not conquer? As we think about how to use, manage, care for the resources that have been entrusted to us, what will cultivate life and flourishing and the potential of life rather than conquering it in some way? We see this, whether we explicitly name this or not, we see this played out in the life of our congregation all over the place. So take, for example, the current COVID-19 season that we find ourselves in. I think we've seen this question played out an awful lot. So one example of that would be when the elders got together and began to process, like, do we continue to meet during this season or not? I was told that it was actually a really easy decision for them because they began to think about the people that make up our community, the resource that we have in the people in our community, right? The greatest resource that we have in our community. And they began to think about the ways that meeting would begin to affect individuals. And they said, listen, for us not to meet would actually be cultivating life and flourishing and the potential for life. And yeah, we could like put our foot down and say we're gonna continue to meet in person and conquer this decision, but that's not what we're about as a congregation. We're about cultivating, not conquering. And so they ultimately made the decision not to meet in person. But then we began to think, like, what do we do now? Like, it seems like we have people, right? Our greatest resource as a community. So what? How do we continue to cultivate life and flourishing the potential of life there? And we also began to think, well, we have technology, we have computers, we have cell phones, we have internet. Can we begin to cultivate life through some sort of online gathering, some sort of online worship service, which is ultimately what we're doing now? This is an attempt to cultivate our shared life, our shared flourishing, our shared potential for life together. We have also seen this played out as people are using their gifts, their talents, their abilities, and making masks and dropping those off for people or offering to run errands for other people. We also see this being played out in the announcement of our stimulus jubilee fund from this past week. It's born out of this idea that if some of us have excess and some of us have need, well, the best way to cultivate life flourishing and the potential of life is to redistribute those funds so that others can have their needs met. This is a way of cultivating life rather than conquering life. Now, outside of the season of COVID-19, we also see this all over the life of our congregation. One example that comes to mind is painting the basement. And if you're not aware of the backstory behind this, the Lighthouse came to us and they said that their fourth and fifth graders use the basement every day during the after-school program. And they began to hear from the fourth and fifth graders that they felt like they were going to a lesser place than the Lighthouse because it wasn't quite as bright and fun and cheery. And so they said, hey, if we cover all of the resources, can we paint it? We began to think through, like, yeah, this really is the best way to steward this resource of our facility if it's going to cultivate life flourishing and the potential of life in these fourth and fifth graders. Because spaces matter. Spaces can cultivate a desire for learning and a desire for growth. And so we said, yeah, absolutely, please paint the basement, spruce it up for the fourth and fifth graders. We also saw this with talking through voting on an air conditioning unit a couple years ago, right? I know that at the moment, not everybody necessarily wanted to do that, but we began to acknowledge that we had the funds to do it, and we also acknowledged that the heat was preventing some people from being able to be part of our Sunday morning gatherings. And so we began to ask, well, what does it look like to cultivate rather than conquer? And we ultimately decided to get the air conditioning because this was something that was cultivating life and cultivating an open and accessible facility for all people, even those that may have health conditions that that summer can make really difficult for them. See, all throughout the life of our congregation, we're asking this question of what will cultivate, not conquer. And we want to keep this on the front of our minds as we think about how we use, manage, and care for resources. I have a friend who's a financial planner that works for Everence, and he told me that he will often tell his clients that hoarding money is not good stewardship. And I think the same can be true with any sort of resource. Hoarding resources is not good stewardship. But rather what good stewardship is asking the question of what will cultivate, not conquer. Justo Gonzalez would go on and is also quoted as saying, that true stewardship is living in the present, knowing that you will have a different future. A true steward knows that there is a different order coming, an order of love and justice and peace. And friends, we want to be a community that values being stewards of the resources that we have. And as we are following Jesus and as we are committed to reconciliation, we recognize that there is a new order coming. And this new order is called the kingdom of God. And so we want to be co-creators. We want to have dominion, control, power, authority over the resources that we have in a way that cultivates, not conquers. We want to be co-creators with God. We want to steward our resources in a way that truly does bring about an order of love and justice and peace. Friends, may it be so in the life of our community.